I'd like to welcome everyone to class this morning. Lesson 90 today, and I titled Lesson 90, Grace and Glory Days, the relationship between Dahan, Baltimore, and O'Hare. Things seemingly by the week are getting more and more interesting. Been in contact some more this week with Dr. DeWitt, and he has officially added me as a research assistant to the paper that he's presenting. And we've been in conversation. He's coming to Grand Rapids in March to present something at the GGF Leadership Conference, and I plan on meeting with him at least a couple times to talk about some things. And some things are in the works for a paper on the 1930s, and he's asked me if I want to be involved in that with him. So we got to sort of see what's up with that and if that can be worked out or not. But who was Martin Dahan is the first topic for this morning. Who was M.R. Dahan? Martin Ralph Dahan was born in Zeeland, Michigan on March 23, 1891, the son of Ritzy Dahan and Johanna Rosema. While at Hope College, he was an effective member of the debate team. Martin went on to earn the degree Doctor of Medicine in 1914 from the Abraham Lincoln Medical School of the University of Illinois in Chicago. As valedictorian of the class of, should say, 1910, he entered the practice of medicine in Byron Center, Michigan. M.R. married Priscilla Van Huysen, I think, right? Point number two, at the height of Dr. Dahan's medical career, he was struck down by an event in which he became patient rather than physician. He suffered an infection after cutting himself while attending to a patient developing blood poisoning, and lay in Blodgett Hospital on the brink of death. He was conscious enough to cry out to the Lord to save him, and with his pleas, he made a pledge to serve the Lord and him alone for the rest of his life. He survived the ordeal and was committed to become a missionary. So he gets sick here. He is attending to a patient. He contracts blood poisoning and almost dies. And if you read Boss Loper's account here from his book, he basically thinks he's going to die. He calls out to the Lord to save him, so on and so forth. It makes an agreement, basically, that if God spares his life, he'll become a missionary and so on. This kind of reminds me a lot of what happened to Martin Luther. Martin Luther was caught in a rainstorm in the middle of an open field and thought he was going to die, and, you know, has his face in the mud saying that if God spares his life, he'll become a monk. Well, Dahan is on his deathbed and says this and so on. Point number three, Martin Dahan, M.D., sold his practice, his home, and his horse for $10,000 and moved his wife Priscilla and two little girls, Ruth and June, to a home on Central Avenue between 15th and 16th Street in Holland, Michigan, and enrolled in Western Theological Seminary. He continued the practice of medicine in an office on the second floor of his home while he was a student, and sired two sons, Richard and Marvin. Dahan graduated from Western Seminary as a member of the class of 1925. He received a call from Calvary Reformed Church in Grand Rapids. His examination for ordination by the classes of Grand Rapids was sustained on May 21, 1925, with great satisfaction to the classes. In 1925, the Calvary Reformed Church had 182 members. In the spring of 1926, it was reported that Calvary Church has been richly blessed, 54 families, that should say, having been received on confession. No, I'm wrong. 54, sorry, having been received on confession, of which 32 were married people. So just to summarize, he's a doctor. He gets sick from blood poisoning while attending to a patient. He thinks he's going to die. He says that if he God spares his life, that he will enter into the ministry. He goes and he studies at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan. He eventually, when he graduates in 1925, he becomes the pastor of this church, Calvary Reformed Church here in Grand Rapids. And within a year, you know, his congregation is growing by 54 members. On April 5th, at the spring session of the classes of Grand Rapids in 1927, Calvary Church reports the most successful year in its history. 60 members were added on confession and 48 by letter. Absolute peace and harmony now prevail, and the midweek prayer meetings are attended regularly by 150 to 200 people. By the spring of 1927, the congregation had grown from 183 members to 360 members. The budget increased in 2 years from $9,000 to $25,000. A $45,000 building project increased the seating capacity of the church from 650 to 1,422. During this time, DeHaan's annual salary was $3,000. He declined a salary increase of $1,000 and accepted instead the same amount for a pastor's discretionary fund. By the spring of 1928, 223 more new members had been received. Early in 1929, Reverend M.R. DeHaan, M.D., was preaching to throngs crowding his church and to a citywide audience on the radio. Ads appearing in the Grand Rapids Press point out that the services at Calvary Reformed were broadcast on the radio and ministry held to be specific doctrinal statement. Quote, "We believe in the Bible as the inspired Word of God, that Jesus is the Son of God and the only means of salvation, and that He was born of a virgin, that He died on Calvary and rose victorious over death and the grave, that He ascended to heaven and is now our advocate, and that His premillennial return is imminent. We do not compromise with the world or modernism." Now you can see in there the issue of the statement there about the premillennial return. Okay? DeHaan is a premillennialist. What do we already know about what happened with Bultema and his dispensational premillennialism and where that got him with the Reformed Church? It got him kicked out. Okay? So DeHaan, somewhere along the line here, has picked up on a premillennial interpretation. So that leads us to point number two. Well, let's stop. Any questions or comments about point number one? Just general issues about DeHaan. Yeah, Mike?
Calvary Reformed is still, the building still exists. It's over on Fulton Street across from Aquinas College. There's now two other church services in there on Sundays. One of them is Chuck Smith's group of people that meet there on Sundays. But that building is still around.
DeHaan's removal from the Reformed Church, point number one, or bullet number one. Meanwhile, however, it had become apparent that DeHaan's preaching was in conflict with the doctrinal standards of the Reformed Church in America. His dispensational, fundamentalist, premillennial interpretation of the Bible, based on his use of the Scofield Reference Bible, was in conflict with the teachings of his denomination. In addition, he rejected the Reformed view of infant baptism to be administered to believers only at the time of their conversion and public confession of faith in Christ. So DeHaan is really against here some of the core beliefs of what the Reformed Church stood for, okay? And just like it happened with Bultema, he's going to get into trouble with his denomination over this. A committee of the classes of Grand Rapids learned not only DeHaan, but also 17 out of the 24 members of his consistency at this point clashed with the doctrinal standards of the Reformed Church in America. The consistency of Calvary Reformed Church at the classes meeting on January 25, 1923 requested that a committee of classes be appointed to meet with the consistency of Calvary Reformed Church at its regular meeting of February 5, 1929 to discuss the matter pertaining to the relations of Calvary Reformed Church and the Reformed Church in America caused by doctrinal differences. Now look at this is happening pretty quick here, okay? DeHaan is taking the church in 1925, and by 1929 there's already trouble between him, 17 members of his, for lack of a better term, his board, and with the denomination. So this is happening now in early 1929. At the classes meeting on February 26, the chairman of the committee, Mr. John A. Dykstra of the Central Reformed Church, reported that the consistency of Calvary affirmed that a thorough study of God's Word based on a dispensational division of the Scriptures led them to hold that infant baptism is not in accordance with Holy Writ. They further stated that they could not continue under the program of the Reformed Church in America under existing conditions, standards, and government. On February 26th, a set of six charges against DeHaan was signed by nine men of one of the churches of the classis, was filed. Neither the nine men nor their church was identified in the records of the meeting of the classis. The charges were shortly thereafter published in a local newspaper. So this is being public, okay? This is going to be all over the city of Grand Rapids. A special session of the classis was set for March 14th at Seventh Reformed Church when classis was to hear the charges and DeHaan was to be confronted with them. DeHaan, however, did not appear. Another meeting was then called for April 2nd, at which time neither DeHaan nor an elder from Calvary Reformed appeared. Classes did proceed with the presentation of an action on the charges. The charges were, number one, conduct unbecoming a minister of the gospel. Number two, maliciously maligning his fellow ministers through slander and libel. Number three, taking his vow and entering the ministry of the Reformed Church with deceit. Number four, maliciously having broken his ministerial vow. Number five, being unreformed in doctrine. And number six, with perpetrating fraud on the denomination. So these are the charges that they bring up against DeHaan. Again, these are printed in the newspaper, and a meeting is scheduled for March and April, and DeHaan does not show up at either one of these meetings. And it explains why here in a second. So while all this was going on, what was soon to be known as Calvary Undenominational Church was formally organized on February 26, 1929. The reason why DeHaan doesn't show up is because in DeHaan's mind, he's already what? He's already gone. He's already left the Reformed Church in America because as of February 26, 1929, he's moving to establish a new assembly. Okay. The first public service was held on Wednesday evening, March 6, in the Orphan Theater. DeHaan explained that he did not appear at either session of the classis on March 14 or April 2 because he had resigned and considered himself no longer under the jurisdiction of the classis. He also stated publicly that he was troubled by the fact that men appointed to be in charge of the meeting were known to be opposed to him, and he further explained to a friend on the telephone the night before the meeting of April 2nd that he would have attended the meeting if other men had been in charge. He considered it a waste of time to attend a meeting where he would receive no chance of an honest consideration. Classis went ahead with the trial, without DeHaan. M.R. DeHaan was found guilty on all charges and deposed from the ministry of the Reformed Church in America as of April 2, 1929. On Sunday morning, March 10, DeHaan began a new ministry in the, how do you pronounce this? Orpheum Theater at 322 Monroe Avenue. The building was filled to capacity with 1,100 persons. How can you start a new church and have 1,100 people there for the first meeting? Gee. His sermon was number 6 in a series on the tabernacle. DeHaan's followers continued at the theater while the large men's Bible class of more than 200 members met at the Rowe Hotel. Subsequently, since the theater could be used only temporarily while it was undergoing renovations, the new congregation made a couple of moves that included the East Grand Rapids High School Auditorium in June and the St. Cecilia Auditorium. In June of 1925, nearly 800 people were attending midweek prayer meetings. DeHaan's following was growing so rapidly that larger quarters, had to be found. Suddenly, the Michigan Street Elementary School property became available and was purchased for $12,500. Within 5 months, at a cost of $120,000, a new auditorium was constructed adjacent to the old school building, which was renovated and used for a Sunday school of 1,000. Moved into the new structure on January 26, 1930. Dedicatory services were held on January 29, 30, and 31. Now watch this. The speakers on these successive evenings on the subjects of the dwelling place of God, God's Son in me, and the Christian's relation to Abraham and Moses were Harry Baltima and John Bennick of Muskegon and J.C. O'Hare of Chicago. So, two of the speakers that speak at the dedication of the Hahn's new church building are Baltima and O'Hare. Okay? And this is happening in January of 1930. Okay? In February of 1930, Calvary Undenominational Church hosted a 14-day Bible conference, which included J.C. O'Hare of the North Shore Church in Chicago. This means that DeHaan was personal friends with two of the Grace Movement's early leaders during the late 1920s and early 1930s, Harry Baltima and J.C. O'Hare. Now, any general questions or comments about that point?
So do you think that DeHaan became a premillennial by talking to these guys, like O'Hare and especially Baltima, who had some similar experience?
I think it's highly likely.
Because he went to Western, he'd be sitting under Albertus Peters, who was the president of the seminary, and he'd be like Schaefer is to Dallas Seminary.
I think it's highly possible. I think it's the Schofield Reference Bible, number one. Okay. And number two, living in this area that whole time of Michigan, DeHaan no doubt knew who Baltima was. And there's similar circumstances of being in the Reformed Church or the Reformed Church in America and being, you know, excommunicated because of their premillennial dispensationalism probably led to a natural gravitation of those men toward each other, I would think. I try to put myself in their position, and I think that makes sense to me that would have happened.
A good Reformed Church of America pastor.
What's that?
Why wouldn't he be just a good Christian Reformed or a Reformed Church of pastor? What made him?
DeHaan?
Yeah, examine premillennialism.
I think mostly it was the Schofield Reference Bible.
But Albertus Peters wrote booklets against it. I mean, the tenure of the Times was that this was condemned, the Schofield Bible.
Yeah, I unfortunately, Mike, I don't know the answer to that. I just know that that's what happened.
Yeah.
I wish I could tell you more about how and why it happened,
yeah.
But apparently it does. But now, this is important, though. Okay, so this is January and February 1930. And who's at both these meetings?
O'Hare.
Okay? So O'Hare is at both these meetings here in Grand Rapids in January 1930 to dedicate the new church building and for a 14-day Bible conference in February of 1930. So O'Hare and O'Hare and DeHaan are what? They're friends. So is Baltima. They're friends. All three of these guys know each other. They're all ministering together at certain meetings here, starting with what's going on in Grand Rapids here in January 1930. Okay? Now, this is important. So, O'Hare, Baltima, and DeHaan, all three for sure are at that meeting. These two are at that meeting, but they all know each other, and they are all, you know, friends with each other in ministry at roughly the same time. Okay? Questions about that? I'll tell you why I think this is important as we go through the lesson. But this is 1930. Remember, what year was O'Hare's Indianapolis Insight about no water baptism? Hopefully you remember that from a few weeks ago. That was 1920. Okay? So I should probably give myself more room here. So 1920, O'Hare has his Indy Insight, as Dr. DeWitt has called it. So 1920 is O'Hare comes to the position on no baptism, no water, I should say. Okay, all the way over here now in January 1930 and February 1930, you have O'Hare, Baltima, and DeHaan are all having ministry together. Okay,
So my point is that 10 years later, has O'Hare left this fundamentalist group, this fundamentalist fold yet?
No.
No. Now let's keep going.
Baltimore questions water baptism is the next point. In his autobiography, Valiant and Diligent for the Truth, Harry Baltimore recounts the influence his book Maranatha, as well as his subsequent dismissal from the Reformed Church, had in sweeping many into the premillennial camp. Pastor Baltimore recounts how many throughout West Michigan, in cities like Grand Rapids, Holland, Kalamazoo, and Grand Haven, joined saints from across the country in severing their connections with the Reformed Church. In addition, Baltimore recalls fondly how many of these men met regularly at the Berean classes. Pastor Baltimore makes an ambiguous statement about a brother, Gerard Knoll, pastor of Reeds Lake Baptist Church at the time of his writing, showing, quote, that we had the baptismal question from the start. Regarding this reference to the baptismal question, Pastor Baltimore goes on to state, Brother Van Dyke of Holland differed on this point with the brethren, and to this there were various debatable questions, such as the law, Pentecost, hymn singing, and the place of creeds. While these comments are not as clear as one might like, they do appear to be proof that the subject of water baptism, as well as dispensational subjects, was being discussed by the Berean classes in the early 1920s. What is clear, however, is that about 1925, it was about 1925 when Pastor Baltimore began to question the necessity of water baptism for the present dispensation. Regarding this matter, Baltimore states, quote, in the midst of all the confusion, I dreaded to add to the confusion. And after 1925, I have never urged any soul to leave any church in order to make a new denomination. It was about that time that I began to get doubts about the whole baptismal question for this age. It's horrible confusion, disagreement, and diversity among godly brethren, first of all, raised doubt in my mind. But for a considerable time, I could not find interest or time to enter into this not-so-easy question. Speaking at the Gold Lake Conference, I once gave many reasons why the one baptism of Ephesians 4:1-5 could not be water baptism. That settled my ministry there, of course. So, Baltimore says that he, as early as 1925, begins to question the issue of water baptism and its necessity and so on. But then he says that he kept it secret for a considerable amount of time, that he did not make it public. Okay? And the reason for that, I take in the first statement when he says there in the quote, in the midst of all the confusion, I dreaded to add to the confusion. I think that Baltimore just felt in 1925 that things are already crazy, and I don't really think it's wise right now for me to go public with these views. But according to his testimony in his autobiography, he sees that as early as 1925. Okay? Now look. So now you got DeHaan dedicating a new building, having two guys that as of 1930 don't believe in what?
Water baptism.
Baltimore has not gone public yet with this belief, I believe, but I'm sure they have been discussing these things to some degree privately. But the point is that here you have Baltimore in 1925 questioning the issue of water baptism. We're going to see in a few weeks, I think he goes public with that in 1933, Baltimore does. But here you have this year in here where all three of these guys are ministering together. So let's finish that point and then we'll take some questions. According to this testimony, it appears Baltimore had seen for a considerable time, quote, the issue of the one baptism in Ephesians 4 not involving water before he publicly taught it at the Gold Lake Bible Conference. I wish he would have said what year he taught that at Gold Lake, but he does not. Okay? He does not state what year he taught that at the Gold Lake Conference. But he does say that he first began to question it in 1925, and that it was a considerable amount of time before he went public with it. Any questions about that point?
I was just thinking that, considering those three men, I think you would enjoy a visit with the singer.
Ed McCarthy.
Ed McCarthy. You heard him? Ed was the Bible teacher for those years. He's 90 years old. He's still living right here, right down the road here. It'd be interesting to hear, because he was there. He often sang. He was a great singer and a great Bible teacher. He knew the Bible better than most preachers. So if you've never met him, and he could probably fill in some blanks on that while he's still cognizant of what's going on.
Did he used to go to the Berean Church?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was there when it was one of the founders of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ed McCarthy.
You got any contact information?
You
give me later. Okay.
Yeah. Right down the road, you'd walk over there.
Okay. So next point, grace and glory. So in January 1929, okay, so now look at this. So now we're back, now we'll back up a year, and we'll say a whole year, January 1929, okay? That's a whole year before January 30, when they're dedicating the building at O'Hare in Baltimore there. In January 1929, five men teamed up to create a Bible study magazine titled Grace and Glory. The men included John E. Bennick as editor and M.R. DeHaan, Harry Boltema, and A.H. Walkus, and Moses, whatever, how do you say it?
Claire Copper,
as associate editors. The address for the periodical was 692 Catherine Avenue, Muskegon, Michigan. So look at it. A whole year before, Boltema and DeHaan are now entering into a periodical, Grace and Glory. Now remember the chronology we just read. So these two are clearly talking, this might help answer your question, Mike. These two are talking together in January 1929, the same month. These guys are entering into this, to agree to do this periodical as associate editors in January 1929, the same month, and right around the time when the Reformed Church in America is leveling charges against DeHaan. Okay? So these two guys are clearly talking to each other before January 1929. Now, so that at least establishes some connection of where he may have been getting some of his premillennial dispensationalism from. Yeah.
When did DeHaan start his radio program? That was when he was still Reformed, right?
Yeah. Okay, last point on the page 4. From the first issue to the last in November 1930, so the magazine didn't last that long. The magazine consisted of 32 pages with opening editorials by Bennick, followed by DeHaan's columns on evangelism, Boltema's Signs of the Times,
Claire Copper's
Israel and the Promises, and Walkus, the Sunday School. At its inception, the editor of Grace and Glory, John Bennick, tried to make it clear that the magazine was not intended, contrary to what reports had implied, to set the editor and his associates up against the Reformed churches. Claire Copper especially emphasized his desire to express his views as compatible with the Reformed churches at that time. Although Grace and Glory began in January 1929 as an apologetic for what was deemed to be best in the Reformed church circles, by May of the same year it had become an apologetic for fundamentalism and within a short time became a polemic against the Reformed church and its institutions. Now, look, for me, that just seems obvious that that's going to happen because almost all the guys associated were booted out of the Reformed church. Thomas Bosloper, author of Grace and Glory Days, presents the five men associated with the magazine as being united in their position against the Reformed Church. However, early issues indicate strong differences between the men with respect to baptism. Bennick and DeHaan strongly question infant baptism and advocated baptism by immersion as a New Testament and biblical mode. Whereas, however, DeHaan had a baptistry installed in his new Calvary undenominational church, Bennett did not do so in his Bethel Gospel Chapel. Waucus did not believe infant baptism could be proven biblically, but was willing to practice it. All during this time, 1929 and 1932, Baltimore practiced infant baptism, even though his own heart and mind had begun to question it. However, Baltimore never advocated or practiced water baptism by immersion. Instead, he always questioned it. Bennett insisted that these differences with respect to baptism were no reason to break the fellowship of the grace and glory men.
So, this matches what Baltimore says to some degree. Baltimore says in his autobiography that it's 1925 when he begins to question it, but that he does not go public with it for a considerable amount of time. What Boslover is saying is that between January 1929 and even out to 1932, but especially in the years here, 1929 and 1930, that they're publishing Grace and Glory, all four of the guys do not agree about water baptism. And he says that that Baltimore is still practicing it, but is privately questioning it, which seems to match what Baltimore says in his own testimony in his autobiography.
Have you got a copy of Baltimore's book on baptism?
Yeah.
Okay.
He doesn't really give you much history, though.
Yeah, we probably.
In it, yeah. So, where was I? Unfortunately, due to the lack of clear dating in his autobiography, it is difficult to prove whether or not Boslover's depiction of Baltimore's view on baptism from 1929 to 1932 is accurate. Both Bennett and Baltimore insisted that Paul, when he wrote to Timothy, 2 Timothy 2:15, and instructed him to rightly divide the word of truth, meant to divide Scripture into dispensations. According to this line of thinking, the epistles of Paul then became the character of the Christian life. They quote then from the Scofield Reference Bible. In Paul's writing alone, we find the doctrine, position, walk, and destiny of the church. What this dividing of Scripture accomplished was to make the preaching of the word from the epistles of Paul preeminent in dispensational circles, sometimes almost to the exclusion of the Gospels for some grace preachers, although not for Baltimore and O'Hare. According to the dispensational view of M.R. DeHaan, the kingdom teachings of Jesus had reference primarily to a future kingdom, and many were irrelevant to current kingdom thought, to current Christian thought and life. For this reason, too, the Lord's Prayer being intended for the future kingdom was never used in M.R. DeHaan's church. So it's clear, folks, that DeHaan is a dispensationalist. Okay? He's saying that the majority of the stuff in the Gospels pertains to Israel and the kingdom. And he's rejecting the Lord's Prayer for as applicable in the dispensation of grace. And that's DeHaan doing all that during these same years here between 1929 and 1930. So he clearly is a dispensationalist along with Baltimore. So what the relationship between them is beyond that is difficult to say. Any questions? Well, let's finish that. A larger fundamentalist context may also be noted. In 1930, M.R. DeHaan was elected president of the Independent Fundamental Church of America at a five-day session held at DeHaan's church. So, what also happens here is you have the IFCA founded in 1930, and DeHaan becomes president of it. Now, I am unclear exactly if that's the year it was founded or if that's just the year he became president, but it's late 1920s, early 1930s when the IFCA is founded.
It was 1930 in Cicero, Illinois, a guy named McLaren founded
the
IFCA.
And I think, and it's also right around this time. And I talked to Pastor Jordan in an email that O'Hare drops congregational from the name of the North Shore Church. So a lot of stuff is happening here, okay? And when the IFCA is founded, he is right in there with those guys, as is Baltimore, as is DeHaan. Okay? So O'Hare is in 19,
late 1929, 1930, that O'Hare dropped congregational. But used to be...
I have a booklet here that Mike let me borrow. It says right on it. This booklet dates from 1924, and it says J.C. O'Hare, pastor, North Shore Congregational Church.
So he dropped congregational right around the same time that the IFCA is established, Independent Fundamental Churches of America, and O'Hare is just as much involved in that, I think, as these other guys are.
Yeah.
Later on, the IFCA, with those three men, there was a split even there, a three-way split. That's where the GGF came from, and also the GARB, General Assemblies. The General Assembly didn't think the IFCA emphasized baptism enough, and of course some of our Bereans thought it was too much, so there really was a three-way split.
Yeah,
you could really see it, not so much with the GRBs, but with the IFCA and the GGF, basically have the same church government. They still follow the same path.
But this is setting the table, okay? Because remember, we have a statements in this booklet right here, Unscriptural Cathedrals. Let me remind you of the statement. We talked about it already. Page 26, J.C. O'Hare, I have always believed and taught that the church began at Pentecost. And while I know with that view there arise many questions and problems, the same is true if we postpone the beginning of the body of Christ to the time that Paul reached Rome. He writes this book, and we have not been able to place this book. Please remember back to lesson 85 and 86, okay? He's making Acts 2 statements here when he writes Unscriptural Cathedrals. You need to keep this in mind, because as of 1930, O'Hare is right there involved with these guys in the IFCA, okay?
Stands for All Point Christians Anywhere. Everybody knows that.
So, O'Hare's testimony about DeHaan. Now, this is real important here. J.C. O'Hare, in The Accuser of the Brethren, paints a slightly different picture of the relationship between DeHaan, Baltimore, and O'Hare than Thomas Bosloper depicts in Grace and Glory Days. Okay? Now, you've got to understand, Bosloper is writing from the point of view of the Reformed churches. J.C. O'Hare states the following in The Accuser of the Brethren. Quote, "These two men," he's referring to Haggai and Fuller, who are the authors of O'Hareism, which we'll talk about next week, "these two men know full well that Dr. Martin DeHaan agreed with my dispensational teachings and no water teaching 100% at the time when he was pastor of Calvary Undenominational Church in Grand Rapids." J.C. O'Hare says unequivocally that when he founded this church, he agreed 100% with him about no water. DeHaan did. That's what O'Hare is saying. Let's keep going. "Dr. DeHaan, with full knowledge of what I taught concerning water baptism and the transition period in the book of Acts, after he and Pastor Baltimore had gone into every detail of the teaching," so that also, I think, shed some light on your question, Mike, "invited me to speak for a week to his congregation when they were dedicating their new building." And we know that was January when. So O'Hare says, listen, he invited me to dedicate his building with full knowledge of what I believed about water baptism, and he was in complete agreement with me when he invited me. Okay? "He endorsed from the pulpit what I taught. He sold many of my books to his people, books that set forth in no uncertain language what I believe then and now. He publicly expressed endorsement of my ministry and graciously asked me to come back again." We know that that happened at least in February 1930, "to give more of the same dispensationalism. While I was with him in the first series of meetings, he ridiculed the zealous immersionists, and he continued for some months to preach to his own members what I preached in the special meetings. He was as dry as I was." So what is O'Hare saying here about DeHaan? He says he knew 100% where I was at with water baptism, and he was what?
with me, in agreement with me. He sold my books. He taught the same thing I taught. He invited me back multiple times for more. Another one of O'Hare's booklets, or pamphlets, is titled An Epistle to Mr. Albert Peters. Fortunately, this pamphlet is dated December 1st, 1931. That's this one right here. If you look in the inside cover, it says right here, Chicago, December 1st, 1931. Okay? So, that's almost in 1932. This is the last month of the year 1931. Okay? This helps establish several important facts. First, as late as, so that of doesn't need to be there. First, as of late 1931, Pastor O'Hare and Pastor DeHaan were still friends and enjoying fellowship with one another. Quote, I've just received a copy of the letter in which you continue to abuse, and I now, which you continue your abuse, and I now feel it my duty to reply to the same for the sake of the truth of God. My candid opinion is that you want to include me in your malicious enmity against Pastor M.R. DeHaan because of my fellowship with him. Your charge that I am immoral because I am a friend of Dr. DeHaan is so utterly unkind and unreasonable that my only remark is a suggestion that you avail yourself of the throne of grace and get forgiveness and rid yourselves of the root of bitterness lest you be consumed. But so December now, 1931, O'Hare states plainly in no uncertain terms that he and DeHaan are still what?
Friends.
Okay? Read the next one. Quote, you further state in the same paragraph that Mr. Boltema, Mr. Bennick, and Dr. DeHaan have made premillennialism as interpreted in the Scofield Bible a stench in the nostrils of honest Christian men. I do not doubt that this blessed doctrine is a stench in your nostrils, and it is my honest opinion that your relentless hatred for the blessed truth is the chief cause of your continuous attacks upon Dr. DeHaan and upon brethren, including myself. Now, whose name do we see also listed there that's been here? Boltema. Okay? Third quote from that pamphlet. Of course, you are already aware of the fact that Dr. DeHaan and I do not fully agree as to the why and how of water baptism. But there is a vast difference between your why and how and his why and how. If one is scriptural, the other is altogether unscriptural. They have nothing in common. So apparently these guys didn't see it exactly the same way. But what O'Hare is pointing out to the professor there is, look, if he's right at all, you're totally wrong. And if you're right, he's totally wrong. Okay? So clearly, as of late 1931, going into 1932, are these guys still friends? Does O'Hare still view himself as being in fellowship with DeHaan? Okay? The second important fact established in an epistle to Mr. Albert Peters is the pamphlet Unscriptural Cathedrals. Let me just read that again. The second important fact established in an epistle to Mr. Albert Peters is the pamphlet Unscriptural Cathedrals, in which O'Hare states, quote, I have always believed and taught that the church began at Pentecost, was already in print by December 1st, 1931. Consider the following statement. Quote, that thought-provoking question, even provoking me to write my booklet entitled Unscriptural Cathedrals. Now, folks, I'm going to give myself some more room here. That's in a document that we have a clear date on, correct? The date of it is December 1st, 1931. O'Hare and DeHaan are still friends. As of this dating. But notice what it says. As of 1931, what is already in print? Unscriptural Cathedrals. Because he refers to it in his letter dated December 1st, 1931 that he's already written on scriptural cathedrals. You with that? Okay? We are now in a position to more accurately date unscriptural cathedrals. Okay? Which I'm just going to abbreviate as UC hereafter. And to understand more of the chronology of O'Hare's theological development. We now, based on the above quotation, think that UC was written, it had to have been written before December 1931. The UC pamphlet itself contains advertisement for both the great blunder of the church and have you received the Holy Spirit since you believed? Okay?
So, if you look at the back of this, and I'll show you in a second, there are two books advertised. One is, I'm going to abbreviate it. I'm just going to call it Blunders. And the other one is, Have Ye Received the Spirit? Okay? So these are advertised in the back of one scriptural cathedral. So let me show this to you, okay? This is the kind of stuff. So right here, top of the page, dispensational study in big print, the great blunder of the church. Everybody sees that. Okay, in smaller print right down here, it says, Have you received the Spirit since you believed? Does everybody see that?
Yeah.
Right here. Have you received the Spirit since you believed? Okay? Now, these are advertised in UC. On scriptural cathedrals, had been written before what? December 1st, 1931, because he references back to it. Is everybody with me so far? This one advertises the great blunder of the church and a booklet called Unscriptural Cathedrals. Okay? No, have you received the Spirit, sorry, since you believed. Therefore, halfway through that point, therefore we know that Unscriptural Cathedrals was written after the great blunder of the church and have you received the Spirit since you believed, because it's advertising them. The pamphlet, Have Ye Received the Spirit Since You Believe, contains in the back a letter by Pastor O'Hare addressed Dear Christian Friend that is dated January 1st, 1929. So here it is. This is, Have You Received the Spirit Since You Believe? Bought this off the internet. And there it is. January 1st, 1929. So the earliest that this could have come into print is what?
January 1929.
That's the earliest. Okay? Now think with me here. Okay? This we know dates from at least January 1st, 1929. Correct? But Unscriptural Cathedrals advertises it. Which means Unscriptural Cathedrals is between January 1st, 1929 and December 1st, 1931. Everybody with me on that? Now this is key, guys, because that means that the Acts 2 statements that O'Hare makes in Unscriptural Cathedrals date from somewhere between late 1930 and early 1931. So he has still not changed his dispensational view as of late 1930, early 1931. Yes?
I'm just putting all this stuff in with the other things that we know were going on right then. January 1929, the great blunder of the church is written, and that's when the classes comes out to Calvary Reformed to have the discussion with them and find that Behan and 17 of his consistory are dispensational. And then the Unscriptural Cathedrals, I think, coincides with the founding of the ISBA.
So let's do it differently, okay? Let's do it like this. January 1st, 1929, Have You Received the Spirit is written. Okay? We know that because it's dated, okay? And if you look in this, guess what you will not find advertised? Not only will you not find Unscriptural Cathedrals advertised, but you will also not find the Great Wonder of the Church advertised. Okay? Now, we also know from the letter to Elbert Peteris that December 1st,
1931, he's making reference to what? Unscriptural cathedrals. Okay? So between this date and this date, you have great blunders written. I'll just keep consistent. And you see. And this hasn't been written before this, because this advertises this. Is everybody with that? So you take all of that and compare it with our general scheme, and you see that O'Hare is still, he's in the IFCA, because aside from the water baptism issue, O'Hare is still teaching Acts 2 dispensationalism as of late 1930, early 1931. Now this, maybe I'm the only dork that like gets excited about this stuff, but this is key to understanding the chronology of O'Hare. Okay? This has him all the way in the 1930s, still with teaching, or at least unclear dispensationally what his position is. When all the way back in 1920, he had first adopted a position of no water. So all through this chronology, Baltimore, DeHaan, O'Hare are seemingly teaching no water, but are still holding to a traditional Acts 2 dispensational view. Now this is to me a big deal. Because I think what happens, what causes more so than baptism, there are, as Leah pointed out, there are different streams here off this IFCA. You have the Baptist group, and then you're going to have the Grace group. Okay? The Baptist group obviously are ticked off at O'Hare in Baltimore over the no baptism thing. The other group in the IFCA gets mad at them because they're going to change their position on when the church began. I know I've just said a lot. Any questions about all that? Mike?
Is the Unscriptural Cathedrals book the only booklet that you found that makes statements about Pentecost being the...
We're getting ahead of it a little bit.
Oh.
But I'm going to suggest to you that as of August 1935, when he writes issue number one of Bible Study for Marines, he's still making Acts 2 statements.
When did he leave the IFCA?
The Worldwide Grace Testimony is not found until 1939. Okay. And then in the 40s, an offshoot of that group is the GGF.
So as late as 1935, he's still teaching Pentecostism.
He is still exhibiting the same confusion that he exhibits in unscriptural cathedrals. He seems to be aware. He says, listen, this is what I've always taught, but I know there are problems here that I can't answer. And he's saying, you see the same mentality in August 1935.
Where does Charles Baker come in on this?
Charles Baker becomes a guest writer for Bible Studies for Bereans in late 1935. And by the time you get to the end of 1935, beginning of 1936, they have left Acts 2-ism. Okay? But I'm getting ahead there, okay? But to answer your question, yes, there are other statements. So let's go back to the notes. When one considers that the O'Hareism booklet, written by W.A. Hagei, first appeared in 1930, a more precise date comes into focus. On page 26 of Hagei's pamphlet, there is a footnote reference to O'Hare's The Great Blunder of the Church. Please recall that unscriptural cathedrals advertise The Great Blunder of the Church, thereby indicating that it was already in print before UC, before Unscriptural Cathedrals. If O'Hareism was written in 1930, and it makes reference to the Great Blunder of the Church, and this work was written before Unscriptural Cathedrals, then that places the earliest possible date of Unscriptural Cathedrals at late 1930. Therefore, we appear safe in concluding that Unscriptural Cathedrals dates from late 1930 or early 1931.
thereby placing it in print before O'Hare addressed his epistle to Albert Peters in December 1931. This, of course, means that O'Hare was still holding the traditional view that the church began at Pentecost as late as 1930-1931. When one considers that by the time O'Hare wrote The Unsearchable Riches of Christ in 1941, it becomes apparent that the 1930s were a decade of great change in the dispensational thinking of J.C. O'Hare. Now, everybody, I have a chart that I've constructed to try to help you with this.
Got to get through this stuff here. All right, so, I missed some of the animation, so just bear with me. 1945, he writes The Accuser of the Brethren. Okay? In The Accuser of the Brethren, he states, in July 1923, more than 22 years ago, I was called to become pastor of North Shore Church. And he says he did not believe in or practice water baptism when he became the pastor. Okay? So you count back, that'd be July 1923, O'Hare accepts the pastor to the North Shore Church. Alright? So that's a time period of 22 years. Everybody with that? He further says in The Accuser of the Brethren, he says that more than 2 years before I became the pastor at the North Shore Church in 1920, he had his meetings there in Indianapolis where he rejected water baptism for the dispensation of grace. Okay, now this is all stuff we've already went over. Alright? So here you have 1945, you go back 22 years, he becomes a pastor. He says he had already rejected water baptism or the practice of it. And then he says, also in The Accuser of the Brethren, you go back more than three years before that, and he's in Indianapolis in 1920 where he recounts how he accepts the position of no water. Alright? Now, so that means that from 1920 until he wrote The Accuser of the Brethren in 1945, O'Hare never changed his views on baptism. Alright? And even though for some of this time, he still began the church at Acts 2. Is everybody with that? We know that in 1939, the Worldwide Grace Testimony is founded. Alright? We also learned in a previous lesson that in 1940, he wrote a booklet called Pentecostalism, Bullingerism, and the Worldwide Grace Testimony. And in this booklet here, he states emphatically that the belief of the Worldwide Grace Testimony is that the church, the body of Christ, began at some point in the book of Acts before Paul wrote Romans. Okay? So he is officially not Acts 2, and he is officially not Acts 28. He views the church as beginning at some point in the Acts chronology before Paul wrote the book of Romans. So even as of 1940, he is still not Acts 13. He is somewhere, he's still working it out. Then we also know that in 1941, he writes The Unsearchable Riches of Christ. Okay? Now here's the new information. In 1929, he writes, Have you received the Spirit? In 1931, he wrote an epistle to Mr. Elwood Peters. At some point here between 1930 and 1931, he writes Unscriptural Cathedrals. And so in late 1930, early 1931, O'Hare wrote Unscriptural Cathedrals, in which he clearly states, I've always believed and taught that the church began at Pentecost. And as I said, we said a few weeks ago, it seems that he did not immediately accept the mid-Acts view. Okay? Now, this information here is key information to understanding and establishing a chronology of what's going on in the thinking and the ministry of O'Hare. Okay? So even as of 1931, he is still friends with Dehan. Okay? According to O'Hare's testimony, Dehan does not believe in water baptism either. He was just as dry as O'Hare, according to what O'Hare says. And he is still O'Hare's involved in the founding of the IFCA. He drops congregational from the name of the North Shore Church, and he is still making an Unscriptural Cathedral statements that are very Acts 2 in their theology. Okay? Alright, I just said a lot. Are there any questions?
I have a comment about the 1941 publication of Unsearchable Riches. I think you have to remember that he did not write all of that in 1941. Those were a collection of pamphlets. God only knows when he wrote them, but they were a collection of works that he put together for that book, in my opinion. I don't think he sat down and wrote that Unsearchable Riches all at one time. That may be a collection.
I don't know about that. You might be right. I'm not sure. I don't know that you can find, though, those individually in print before 1941.
They've been unpublished before.
Yeah.
If you look at the variety that he has, he covers a big...
You're right. There is no clear progression in that book. There's just a series of random topical...
I don't use that book so much for dating.
Well, the reason you do that, though, Lee,
the reason I'm comfortable with that is because he has an introduction in that book that is dated.
That's true.
Okay? So... even if he wrote those over a time period, it first appeared in a single volume with the introduction in 1941. Yeah.
Just anecdotally, I cannot accept that J.C. O'Hare would ever write anything and not publish it immediately.
You're possibly correct. I mean, it may have been a bigger project, but we don't know outside of his own statement regarding it. But... I tend to agree with you. I tend to view this as a singular volume that was written, that was published in 1941. Lee might be right as well. I just don't have any way to know for sure. Mike?
Refresh my memory. How do we know that the O'Hagi booklet on here, what year that was written? I don't see any copyrights in any of those.
Yeah, that's a good question. We're going to talk about that next week specifically. Okay. But I have three sources that all say that the first edition of the Haggai booklet came about in 1930. Okay? We'll talk about those next week. All right, we got to quit. We're 5 minutes past. I can see that you're all not as thrilled with this as I am, but that's okay. This is key information, though, to understanding what happened. And I think having clarity on this for the first time, yeah.
I'm thrilled with it.
Okay, that's good. All right, thanks for your attention. We got to quit, though.